Las Vegas was built for stars. And on August 22nd, two of boxing's biggest take center stage. Rolly Romero never follows the script.
This is my game.
Teofimo Lopez has never needed one.
This guy's got a big mouth.
For years, they've had plenty to say.
All you do is talk.
But with world championship gold on the line, can they back it?
Teo, I'm here. I'm going all in.
It's time to put up or shut up. Rolly Romero versus Teofimo Lopez, August 22nd.
I'll shut you up.
Watch on DAZN and DAZN on Prime Video.
Hey there, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a brand new show. It's called Money Moves. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's close to Halloween, and I thought, what a perfect time to take a look at some of the lore in Louisiana. This is the Tan Report. I'm your host, Tan Trung. Louisiana has been the backdrop to plenty of books and movies that fit into the gothic or horror categories. Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire quickly comes to mind. More relatively recent films, like The Last Exorcism 2, have been set in Louisiana as well. In New Orleans, it's not hard to find a ghost or voodoo tour in the French Quarter. And come Halloween, the city just takes on a more macabre quality. So what is it about Louisiana that makes it so fertile for frightening stories?
I think we can't bury our dead too deep here works as both a literal statement and as a metaphor. Louisiana is a place that is, I don't know if you know the term liminal, but it exists in between. Our dirt is somewhere between water and dirt. Our culture, most of our cultures, I'm not just talking about Cajun culture. I've lived in other parts of the state. Louisiana is a place where people and things and waters, fresh water meets salt water.
It's brackish.
It's brackish. Yeah. The everything about it is brackish from the people on up. And I think that that challenges things. And I think that that causes fear. I think that there's an unpredictability to Louisiana. And I think that that presentation has created the reality of Louisiana's instability. And I'm not just talking about our land loss. I'm talking about our political instability, our emotional instability, the juxtaposition of, jeezy crazy, just New Orleans and Baton Rouge, right? There's tension and uncertainty in almost every aspect of this state. And I think that it creates that vibe. It creates that alienness that other people, when they come to Louisiana, you know. And it's not just because the roads suddenly go to crap, right? You know, when you get into Louisiana, there's something about it. And I do feel like it's that collective subconscious sort of tension and awareness. You have to be aware in Louisiana.
That's Alexis Bro. I reached out to her to learn more about one of the more recognizable creatures in Louisiana lore, the Rougarou. One of the first things I learned about the Rougarou is that it's not just a werewolf type of monster, which is how it's often portrayed. Alexis told me the Rougarou is a shapeshifter and can take on many forms. Alexis can relate. She takes on different forms too.
I am an author, illustrator, and I guess as of recently, I'm dubbed a folklorist because I've done a lot of research on Louisiana folklore and stories for not just my books that I've written and illustrated, but also for a podcast that we just started putting out.
That podcast is called Outlandish Parish, and the first episode was dedicated to the Rougarou. And if you want to take a deep dive into the history of the Rougarou, I recommend you check it out. But for us here, Alexis will serve as a sort of guide to the world of Cajun and Louisiana folklore and how the Rougarou fits into that world. When I sat down with Alexis, it was in the kitchen of her mother's home in South Louisiana. Alexis lives next door.
I live in Cutoff, Louisiana, which if you don't know where that is, it's the last Walmart on the way to Grand Isle.
Before we get into the Rougarou and its connection to Cajun culture, I should say Alexis Bro is not the stereotypical Cajun. She'll be the first to tell you that she's a proud nerd, someone who grew up playing Dungeons and Dragons instead of trapping and fishing. It wasn't until later in her life, after being away from Louisiana, that she came back to Cutoff and her Cajun roots.
I'm a equal parts Petrie and A-Bear. I joke that I'm purebred Cajun because that's not really a thing. But my family's been in Lafourche Parish since they came here after the Derangement. And
which is what?
Okay, the Derangement is when the British could not understand how the Acadians wouldn't side with the French in some big war they had up north. And they kicked everybody out of Nova Scotia. And it was very violent. And it was horrible. And you should do your own research on it because it's a lot, but Basically, the British took control of the area of Acadie in Nova Scotia that the Cajuns were living in, and the Acadians spent, they were a population without a home for anywhere from 10 to 30 years, depending on which little pocket. A third of them escaped, a third of them died, and a third of them survived, and a vast majority of that third that survived did eventually wind up in South Louisiana, which is where the Acadian population comes from, and the Cajun population kind of started to coalesce.
And that's your people.
These are my people.
What was that like for you to kind of tap into that history that was really embedded in your family?
It reminds me of learning that, like, you, like I was today years old. Like, it really made me, it made me feel regretful that I hadn't gotten it sooner and that I hadn't seen it when I was here. You know, the internet was just coming out when I was in high school. The world was everywhere but here. So when I came back and to see that all the things that I had been looking for in every other culture already existed in my own culture, there was some self-deprecation. There was a lot of me, oh my gosh, why didn't you see this sooner? Why did you have to go away? But I think that there's something to the fact that a lot of writers, a lot of philosophers, I'm pretty sure even Buddha sat there and said, you know, you go out into the world and you come back and you see your home with new eyes. And
it was part of the journey.
Yeah. And it was definitely, that was my journey, was I needed to be outside of it to be able to see it. And as an artist, as an illustrator, I'm still sort of outside of this culture because I'm not a shrimper. I don't, you know, I'm not a hunter. I can barely fish, but you know, as a person who was gone for so long, I can still have that perspective where I can sit back and appreciate it in a way that some people can't. It's been, you know, the work of a lifetime. Sometimes I feel like I'm playing catch up because I didn't learn these things when I was younger.
She may have started late, but it seems like Alexis has fully embraced the Cajun inside her. You can find her on Instagram giving tutorials on Cajun French.
Hey everybody, Alexis Bro here, coming at you again from Frenchman Street with your Cajun word of the day. And today, that word is chat, as in cat. Now we also use mignon in Cajun French, but today I'm talking about le chat avec un tache. The Spotted Cat Music Club, by far the best place for live music on Frenchman Street.
Alexis has written several children's books with Cajun themes, including a book titled 1-2 Rougarou. Oddly, she didn't grow up hearing about this Cajun creature in her house.
I was not raised with a lot of folklore. My grandpa was a nerd. Like, if you just imagine...
So are you, though.
I really am. We liked watching Jeopardy together, me and Papa. But he didn't, you know, we listened to Nat King Cole with him, and we listened to, you know, Frank Sinatra. We didn't hear stories about the Rougarou growing up so much. My friends did, and we would, you know, sort of childhood boogeyman gossip. But I really came to this academically as an adult. And when I was, like a lot of people in our generation are, sometime in my mid-20s, I wound up back at home with Mom, where I swore I was never going to be. Absolutely not. And one of the things that I used to reacclimate myself to my hometown was studying my hometown the way I'd studied all these other cultures, the way I'd studied other people's folklore. And so it wasn't until I was a little older that I actually started looking at the collections of Louisiana folklore from Mr. Ancelet, Mr. Barry Jean Ancelet out of Lafayette, the collections that they have with the Folklife Collaboration, trying to just talk to the older people of my family about stories and things like that. But it wasn't until I was older, it wasn't something that I was raised with.
Once Alexis immersed herself in Cajun folklore, she discovered a vast collection of characters and creatures.
Our biggest monsters that kind of everybody knows about are the Rougarou, the Foufoulé, our version of the Will-o'-the-Wisp. Even if you're not a folklorist, if you've seen Disney's Brave, those little blue lights that Merida follows through the woods, that's the Will-o'-the-Wisp. The Hawaiian culture has the Night Walkers, and that's the lights that go across the mountains. Basically, I'm sure Vietnam has versions of this too. The lights in the, anywhere you find a marshy area that's going to produce swamp gas, the people there produced a mythology about it. And the Foufoulé is ours. We also have, one of my favorites is Madame de Grandois. It's that translates to the woman with the big fingers. And it's this woman in prairie culture who pulls your toes and maybe pulls them off and like wears them on a necklace around her neck. We also have the Honey Island Swamp Monster, which is supposedly, the story of this is so, so just like cryptid silly, but it's the a train full of chimpanzees wrecked and they crossbred with alligators up on the North Shore. But then
because
you get
that's where all great things happen is on the North Shore.
North Shore. And genetics don't matter and biology laws don't matter on the North Shore. But then you go up to the Argelfargen of Natchitoches, and that's one that very few people know about, but there are actually police reports about this one.
The Argelfargen.
Argelfargen.
Okay.
And there it's a Bigfoot type shape-shifting creature that these two guys, they just swore that this ape woman abducted them back in the day, and they stuck to their stories so much you can actually look up their police reports. That's fairly contemporary. About 80, 90 years ago.
So tell me about the Rougarou. I mean, would you say that the Rougarou in the lore that is down here is like the most known?
I think the Rougarou is come to be known, it's almost become like a universal boogeyman term. Like, we use the term Rougarou for everything from a ghost on the side of the road or a headless corpse sighting and things like this. To say, I saw the Rougarou, because the Cajun concept of the Rougarou differs from the European concept of the Loup-garou in that our shapeshifter can turn into anything. Now, there's some accounts.
But let's go back. What does Loup-garou mean?
Loup-garou, loup is a wolf in French. So a loup-garou is a werewolf. And if you go to Haiti and if you go to other French occupied areas, you're going to see that they still use the loup-garou. The term Rougarou is specific to the Mi'kmaq, Métis tribes of Canada and northern Maine. And, you know, when you come to indigenous nations, the boundaries are a little different. You know, there are parts of their territory that traverse both countries, both the United States and Canada. But you're looking at a story that was born in Nova Scotia and in the where the Mi'kmaq and the most Americans are going to think of them as the Mi'kmaq, but it's pronounced Mi'kmaq, and they're going to, you know, that story was produced there where their indigenous shape-shifting concept met the French concept of the werewolf, and it became something different, and it blended, and it became a different story. And so in Cajun culture, you have the Rougarou, and sometimes there are stories about the Loup-garou, but almost everyone I know says Rougarou, and it is a fluid shapeshifter, not just, it won't just turn specifically into a wolf. Although it does seem to like a wolf form, there is an affinity for the canine aspect, but it's capable of turning into other animals as well.
So any type of monster,
any type of animal, you could see an angry chicken, and it's a Rougarou. You could, like, an animal behaving oddly might be a Rougarou.
But would a Rougarou be always a hybrid of an animal and a human? It could just be a straight up animal.
It could be an animal. Like, you would see it as an animal. I think the Wolfman visual is much more represented in visual media. That's how it's presented. And when you want to draw a Rougarou, whether you're putting it on a beer label or cookies or whatever, zillions of things have Rougarou on them, that's going to be what the artist is going to pull for, because that's what's, you know, it's a visual language. In visual language, the Wolfman hybrid is a Rougarou. But despite that depiction, women could be Rougarou, children could be Rougarou. There wasn't any sort of designation, and they didn't have to be presented as that Wolfman hybrid. But I have heard stories about people seeing that sort of halfway between a wolf and a man character, that seeing that entity in front of them. So there is, you know, it's sticking for a reason.
Was there a reason to tell the story of the Rougarou in Cajun culture and Acadian culture?
Oh, definitely. It was to make sure that you behaved. The Louisiana landscape, like we were talking about earlier, it does exude this eeriness and this scariness, but it's also very scary out there at sometimes, especially
at night.
Well,
you don't want to be wandering in the bayou by yourself. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that can get you.
I mean, even like we're fairly, you know, we've got a Walmart and everything. We're fairly domestic here. And there was an alligator that kept going back and forth here. So even right now, we have to be careful going outside for the snakes and everything. I can't even imagine, you know, how disturbing it was when there were no lights at all and more trees, and the swamp was a lot closer and the marsh was a lot closer. So the Ruguru tends to be one of the scary things that your mama warned you about. You better listen to me or the Ruguru is going to get you. And especially when you talk about, to me, one of the most important aspects of the Ruguru is how tied it is to Catholic culture. Because if there are all kinds of consequences if you don't follow certain religious dictates that you're either going
to... Catholicism's pretty good for that.
Catholicism is very good at scaring you into listening to them.
Reminding you of punishment.
Yes, it is. And reminds you that if you... Like, one of the big things is if you break Lent for 7 years in a row, you're going to become a Ruguru. If you don't, if you go hunting on holy days, the Ruguru might come after you, that he's out in the marsh on holy days... Himself, I guess, somehow pardoned from going to Mass. Maybe he went to midnight Mass. I'm not sure. But the Ruguru is out in the marsh. And if you go hunting on holy days, the Ruguru is going to get you. Or if you see the Ruguru, then you can't hunt for a week.
Man, the Ruguru sounded like an enforcer.
And he's come to have that role in culture, in Cajun culture. The Ruguru is the person who is going to enforce the rules that are imposed upon you. The Ruguru is the creature that's going to make sure, is going to punish you if you don't listen. The Ruguru is he's going to come pull your toes if you don't listen to your mama. You know, it's definitely for all, I mean, we can't go all the way back and see how those, every single story was related, you know, hundreds of years ago. But today's, the stories that I grew up with and the stories that are, you know, people relate now that they heard when our generation was growing up are definitely, you know, the Ruguru as like the sheriff, like the Ruguru as the person who's monitoring the marsh to make sure you behave and monitoring when you go hunting to make sure that you don't, you know, do something terribly damaging when you're out there, or monitor the, I guess, who's going to church and make sure that you're going to comply with the dictates of the Catholic Church. And there's a certain aspect of the Ruguru that is almost seems diametrically like the exact opposite of that.
What I found interesting about the Ruguru is that it's not just some kind of boogeyman lurking nearby. Sometimes people can turn into the Ruguru.
So in the past, or I imagine at some point in Louisiana history, there were people that were perceived to be the Ruguru, or like in towns. And
I mean, in the amount of, like, when I have a story that involves a movie theater in Golden Meadow. So since there have been movie theaters, I mean, a friend of mine told me a ton of stories, and her mom's in her 60s, and this is stories from when she was younger. So we're not talking hundreds of years ago. We're talking about since bell bottoms were invented. There were people that she said her mama and papa, her mama and her aunts, they all lived in a neighborhood kind of like this one where everybody was related. And they would sit in the afternoon and gossip about who in the neighborhood, they just knew they were a Ruguru. They knew they were a Ruguru. And this is like, yeah, like since color TV, you know, not ancient past.
So what would happen to the person that was believed or perhaps branded as the Ruguru of the town?
It seems a lot like... I was talking about seeing those connections. A lot of that seems to, it gives me echoes of times that I've heard about like old witchcraft lore, where it was a person who was already kind of a little weird and already a little bit outside of the margins. There are stories about a person selling their soul to the devil to become the Ruguru. You know, you had to do it on a gravel road on a full moon night. And you had to, you could sell your soul to the devil for the power of being a shapeshifter. And the people who thought that you had done that, you know, they might be wary of you because you had this power, you had this capability that they didn't have. So, I mean, how would any individual, you know, some people might embrace that, some people might stay the heck away from it. But it really seems like a lot of times this was probably a person that was already, for whatever reason,
a little
marginalized. Yeah. I mean, there were goths and emo boys of 1920s. They just, nobody had enough of a diverse wardrobe for them to really stand out. It was all in the attitude and what you chose to read.
And I guess that made them easier targets to be believed or thought of, yeah, as a Ruguru.
And it's you hear stories about and the Ruguru was something you could be relieved of because you could pass the curse on to somebody else in certain instances. If you drew their blood, if like, let's say you were a Ruguru and I wanted to take it onto myself because after so many days, the statute of limitations run out and you're going to be a Ruguru forever. I just have to give a little cut and then I become the Ruguru. I don't have to like decapitate you or shoot you with a silver bullet or anything. Just draw your blood and then I would take that curse onto myself and then it would be passed from one person to another.
Comes up with these rules?
Like, I don't know.
It just gets passed down from
it gets generation. Passed down and like the one of the fun ones that isn't very scary is the 13 pennies. Because one way to guard yourself against the Ruguru was to put a bunch of little things in front of them that they needed to count. For sometimes it's a colander. If you ever see a colander hanging by somebody's door, that seems like a really weird place to put a colander, but it was for not just the Ruguru. If you go back to the older European stories, there are other creatures that are subjected to this law that they have to, if they see a bunch of tiny things, they have to count it. And so you could trap them by distracting them by putting the colander in front of them, because then they'd have to count the holes. Or it could just be ditty guys, like little tiny things. I really like the one that's 13 pennies. And I have a friend of mine, I did a little children's book called 1-2 Ruguru, and he called me up and he said, I had to do home improvement because of you. And I said, what do you mean? He said, my daughter made me route out 13 holes in her door threshold and embed pennies in it and cover them with resin and seal them in so that she would always be safe from the Ruguru. With the Ruguru stories, you really do see these sort of like built-in fail-safes. You know, there's kind of like we were talking about with Catholics. You know, you dig your own grave with a Catholic. You make your choices. And with the Ruguru, a lot of time it is a choice. You're choosing to not go to Lent. You're choosing to hunt on a holy day. You're choosing the action that results in you becoming the Ruguru. It's not something that you're just struggling with.
You're choosing to disobey your parents and walk out in the woods at night by yourself.
Yep.
The Ruguru is going to get you.
Ruguru is going to get you.
I mean, the Ruguru, as we said, the Ruguru was an enforcer, sort of like a reckoner.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I understand, the Ruguru also could be something that you become.
Mm-hmm.
And regrettably, because of your own actions. Like, tell me about that aspect of it. How did that evolve from something that was external, somebody, the boogeyman was going to get you, into something that you could become the monster yourself? Like, how did that come about?
I think that's the case in almost every culture. I mean, if people didn't see themselves in monsters, we wouldn't have the Halloween that we have. You know, I think that with the stories of people for willing to sell their soul to the devil to become the Ruguru, with the stories of people willfully breaking these laws, I think that when you become the Ruguru, it's like you're forced to face your own monster. You're forced to face the ways that you failed, whether it's your community, your family, your church. You're forced to look into yourself. And in that way, it's almost kind of unique amongst a lot of even cryptid and folklore monsters, because you look at other, you know, Bigfoot doesn't have a big moral contingency. You know, there's not a lot of morality connected to Bigfoot lore. There's not a lot of church dogma connected to Mothman up in Point Pleasant. Like, there's not a lot of complicated...
Swamp Thing is not really like, really debating the right and wrongs of his life. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's Alan Moore did beautiful things with a comic book, but like, it's not the actual myths that it comes from aren't really like really morally heavy the way that the Ruguru is. And I think with the Ruguru, you see yourself in it so much that, you know, we all have those shortcomings. We all have those problems. And I think that the Ruguru holds this role in our culture that that there's potential for anyone to become that monster. You know, the kind of like how it's become a name for a bunch of different type of monsters, that also kind of, you know, you could stretch that into thinking that there's potential for all of us to become a Ruguru because we're all potentially capable of doing neglectful things, doing disrespectful things, doing inconsiderate things.
Of course, when you're dealing with the supernatural, something like the Ruguru can instill fear or fright. But Alexis says in the realm of demons and devils, the Ruguru is actually pretty tame compared to the creature it may consider a close cousin.
The Ruguru is actually one of the most subdued werewolves. Like, if you look at the European Loup-Garou, these are horrifying stories. These are like hundreds of people dead, like the beast of...
A lot of carnage.
Oh my lord, like mass decapitations, like there are whole flocks of sheep. It's flocks of sheep, it's herds of cows and flocks of sheep, both slaughtered across the pastures. You know, when you get to European werewolf lore, there is some truly, truly bloodthirsty and gory stuff out there that we don't really have with the Ruguru. The Ruguru is a very individual monster. He doesn't attack a whole town. He doesn't rampage across the countryside, murdering and slaughtering indiscriminately. This is a monster that has a conscience. This is a monster that has a role in our culture. This is a monster that isn't the indiscriminate, you know,
killing machine,
killing thing in the dark. This is a monster that's going to come after you, not by chance, but because of something that you've done. It's a more directed monster, but it is also like a very low on the body count. If you're going to classify the Ruguru with werewolves, and I think most people would, even though it is a shapeshifter, I think it's got a really low body count as compared to a lot of other werewolf mythology.
So where would you rank like the, on a scary level, I mean, would the Ruguru be down near the bottom? Or because it's more personal, should we be more afraid of the Ruguru rather than an indiscriminate killer like the Loup-Garou?
If I were to see anything even vaguely like a Ruguru in my backyard, I'm going to void all my bodily fluids and run, right? Like as far as an in-person interaction, I'm going to be petrified. But as an abstract concept, I think it's kind of one of those things, like if you stay on the right side of a certain moral code, then you're not worried about it.
True to the Cajuns' understanding of the shape-shifting nature of the Ruguru, the modern-day Ruguru can come in the form of a boxer. Well, sort of. New Orleans native and boxer Regis Progray took on the nickname Ruguru as he worked his way up to the title of super lightweight champion.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, USA, the reigning, defending, undefeated WBA super lightweight champion of the world, Regis Ruguru Progray!
Along the bayous in South Louisiana, the Ruguru has morphed into a festival.
Come out to the Ruguru Fest, presented by Louis Mohana Furniture, October 20th through 22nd. A family-friendly festival with a spooky flair, celebrating Louisiana's folklore. Don't miss the...
This year's Ruguru Fest in Houma just wrapped up. It celebrates the rich history of folklore in the region, but it also tries to raise awareness about the challenges down here. The Ruguru Fest benefits the South Louisiana Wetlands Discovery Center, which is dedicated to preserving the disappearing coast of Louisiana, something that is arguably more terrifying than a shapeshifter. Alexis says when it comes to folklore, it's the true stories that are often the most frightening.
Honestly, the scariest stories that we have in Louisiana are the real ones, right? I'm talking about the Carter Brothers vampires from New Orleans. Again, with police records that these men were abducting people and draining their blood and storing it. And then they were captured, and then they were executed, and then they were New Orleans buried, right? It's not interred because there's no earth to put them in, but they were entombed, and then they went to move them out of the tomb because that's what you do in New Orleans, right? Every couple of years you clean house and put a new person in there, and there was nothing in there in either of them. Both of the brothers' bodies were gone. And that's documented. That's not something, that's not oral tradition. That's police reports. You know, the stories of Louisiana get interesting. One of the most haunting tales I know, and one that I definitely grew up with, was the story of the Chenier Caminata hurricane down here. And the imagery of that is excruciating because the thing that I always remember is the women who had drowned and they were hanging by their hair from the trees because they got tangled. This was 1893, right down in Grand, you know, just north of Grand Isle in the Chenier settlement. And that was some imagery that has to be have equivalents in other parts of the state. You know, the idea, the things that you saw from hurricanes and stuff, the stuff that really happened is always way scarier than, you know, some glowing lights in the marsh.
With many communities in Louisiana dealing with the plague of crime and violence, there could be a practical utility in reminding people about a creature ready to stalk those who break a certain moral code. And maybe that's part of the reason why we're so fascinated with mythical beings like the Rougarou. They can sometimes distract us from this notion that the real monsters we should fear are the ones walking among us. In Cutoff, I'm Tan Trung for WWL Radio.
Girl, let's get real. Some pads are just diapers with a good PR team, but not the new Kotex BioCare. That's because Kotex BioCare helps defend against odor and irritants. And it's the first and only pad with this pH proactive system that helps optimize the pad's pH. Just think of it as self-care for down there. Check out Kotex.com for more details on the all-new Kotex, completely redesigned to meet your needs. You asked, we heard.
Las Vegas was built for stars. And on August 22nd, two of boxing's biggest take center stage. Rolly Romero never follows the script.
This is my game.
Teofimo Lopez has never needed one.
This guy's got a big mouth.
For years, they've had plenty to say.
All you do is talk.
But with world championship gold on the line, can they back it?
Teo, I'm here. I'm going all in.
It's time to put up or shut up. Rolly Romero versus Teofimo Lopez, August 22nd.
I'll shut you up.
Watch on DAZN and DAZN on Prime Video.
It's Sophia with an F, Franklin with the Y, and if you're looking for some bubblegum dum-dum podcast, then you are in the wrong place, baby. Whether I'm reminiscing on the trials and tribulations of working in the corporate world to recapping today's latest reality TV show, you're going to want to pull up a chair and stick around. It's a good time and always 100% unfiltered. Follow and listen to Sophia with an F wherever you get your podcasts.